Thanks, Pete. Good afternoon. Hi to those on the webcast. Sorry you couldn't make it today. Air conditioners are running. It's the end of September. Remember this next winter. That's something. Well, we were just in church 48 hours ago or less. So I suppose you don't really need much of a sermon today. I have a real short topic. It's this, that Jesus had a body. He was not a spirit or an angel. Jesus had a body. That's a pretty simple biblical fact. So you probably don't need anybody to elaborate on that fact for you. But that's indeed what I want to say today. Jesus had a body of flesh and blood. So why do I propose to take up your time on such a beautiful day talking about such a thing that is so obvious from the Scriptures? Well, the New Testament spends a lot of time reinforcing that fact, even though they make it obvious. The Scriptures make it obvious. Well, that is precisely why I think we should consider why the Scriptures do that. I think there is a reason why the Scriptures make that fact so obvious. We know that late in the first century, not everyone was clear on that point. There were teachers inside the church, in apostolic times even, who denied that Jesus had a body. They taught that Christ was not human, but that he was a spirit. It was a heresy that the apostles battled even back in the New Testament, and the battle raged stronger as time went on. And it's this context of the New Testament that we need to be aware of. Why did they have to make it obvious that Jesus Christ was a human being, that he had a body? The Bible claims that Jesus was both God and man. Now, modern men, our audience today would easily not believe that Jesus was God, but would easily believe that he was just a man. But in the first century, it was different. They went through a lot of pain to prove to the audience in the first century that Jesus was, in fact, a human. I want to make two points relative to that fact today. One is that the great heresy of the first century was that Jesus Christ was a spirit. Jesus Christ was a spirit. But the main message of the New Testament was that Christ died as a sacrifice. And you cannot die as a sacrifice if you're a spirit. You must be flesh and blood to die as a sacrifice. Well, you notice, and my first point was the heresy. You may not agree with that, but I'm of the opinion that there was basically just one heresy in the New Testament. And that was what I said. Christ was a spirit. A lot of the New Testament deals with wrong ideas that were taught at that time. And there were many different theories over the years about what the heresies were. I mean, you know that the New Testament is full of things contrary to heresies. But what were they? They seem to involve Jewish things sometimes, like circumcision in the law. They seem to involve Greek things sometimes, like asceticism versus sexual abandon. There was talk of extra-biblical fables and belief about spiritual powers. Personally, I think all of those elements were part of, as I said, one heresy. I may be wrong about that. The New Testament doesn't name. Maybe they don't want to dignify the heretics by naming them. But the heretics are not named, so we don't know for sure. But the heresy grew stronger and stronger, not weaker, as the years went by in the New Testament. By the end of his life, and Paul was in prison, and he wrote, when he wrote 2 Timothy, he wrote this to Timothy: "This you know, that all they which are in Asia be turned away from me." Now that's quite a statement, considering that Ephesus and on the seven churches of Asia, that Paul's very fertile ground for preaching and establishing churches was in Asia, the province of Asia. And he says, all of Asia is turned away from me. He didn't mean literally all, I don't think, but much. And maybe 20 more years after that, I mean, Paul died about that time when he wrote 2 Timothy. About 20 years after that, the Apostle John lived in Ephesus. And John writes from Ephesus in 1 John chapter 4, this is probably the most direct statement about this subject that I'm talking about today. This is 1 John 4, 2. Every spirit that confesses not that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh is not of God. This is that spirit of Antichrist. Probably the clearest verse in the Bible that the great heresy that swept away so much of the apostolic church involved this belief that Jesus Christ was not a man of flesh and blood. First John 2:2 says, "Who is a liar?" He uses pretty direct language in 1 John. "Who is a liar but he that denies that Jesus is the Christ?" He is Antichrist, that denies the Father and the Son. I don't think that he denies that Jesus Christ is the Messiah, but I think he denies that Jesus Christ is the Son. They wouldn't deny that Jesus Christ is a messenger sent from God with a message to man, but they deny that he was flesh and blood. You find hints, though, of this heresy throughout the New Testament. So I just started at the end, but I'm going to go through it chronologically. I'd like to just flip through the New Testament to some snatches of that heresy and where it appears chronologically in the New Testament. Some of the first writings in the New Testament are Paul's letters to the Corinthians and the Galatians. Just maybe the epistle of James and the epistles to the Thessalonians, they might have been earlier. But the first time we see this heresy being taught is early on in the epistles of Paul to 1 and 2 Corinthians. Well, it's to the Corinthians. He wrote two letters, right? 1 Corinthians 2. Just flipping here to some of the outstanding examples. 2:1. "I, brethren, when I came to you, came not with excellency of speech or of wisdom, declaring unto you the testimony of God." However, there were people in Corinth who were speaking articulately with supposed wisdom. Probably the wisdom of Hellenistic learning. I would think of Alexandria in Egypt as an example of that. But Paul came preaching the scripture, the testimony of God. Verse 2, "I determined not to know anything among you save Jesus Christ and him crucified." That was the central issue, crucifixion. Paul's not arguing against obeying the laws of God. The Jews of the synagogue are not the problem. I mean, they're a problem. The Jews in the synagogue persecuted Paul and the church. But the teachers of heresy inside the church were not Jews of the synagogue. Paul came preaching that Christ was a human and he died by crucifixion. He's contrasting that against an idea that Jesus wasn't a man at all, but he was a bringer of enlightenment. The only wisdom that Paul preached was the offering of Jesus Christ as a sacrifice, which they would deny. Because he couldn't die. He was the Spirit. We get more characteristics over in chapter 15. That is, characteristics of this heresy. I'm just taking snatches here and there. Chapter 15, verse 12. "Now, if Christ be preached that he rose from the dead, how say some among you that there is no resurrection of the dead?" Is this part of the same heresy or not? Well, if Christ was not a man, then he did not die. What happened to him then after his mission was done? Where did he go? What do we do with Christ's resurrection? Well, their concept of resurrection, I think, was quite different than ours. How many of you saw the movie lately, Noah? That was quite an interesting flick. It's not quite biblical, of course, but it's interesting. In this movie, there are flashbacks. Did some of you see the movie? Noah? Yeah. It piques your curiosity to watch it, although it's not nearly biblical. But there are flashbacks in the movie to creation. And at that time, in the movie, we see angels who are trying to help mankind against a rather unjust and uncaring God, as pictured in the movie. And as punishment for more or less opposing God, these angels are imprisoned on earth in a rather grotesque bodies, rock bodies. Remember those characters if you saw the movie? They play a rather large part in the imaginative role of helping Noah in the movie. Anyway, it was interesting to me what happens to these angels who are trapped in these rock bodies when they actually do God's will and help Noah build the ark. Remember that part? They prove themselves useful to God. They burst out of their stone bodies and flash to heaven in a flash of light. They're released from their prison and return to heaven. Now, when the apostles to Corinth, these alternate apostles to Corinth, preach about a resurrection, they do not envision a man, a dead man, being brought back to life. They envision an immortal soul who is trapped in a human body, just like these angels are trapped in their rock bodies. Their idea of a resurrection is such a soul returning to its divinity. Divine beings returning to heaven. Just as the Christ returned to heaven, so the spiritual ones among us in Corinth, their teaching, will return to heaven when they're fully liberated or finally liberated from their bodies. It's two different ideas, of course, between the movie. I mean, the movie's not about Corinth, but in the movie, it's angels trapped in bodies. But in the theology, the gospel being preached in Corinth, I think we have human beings trapped in bodies, trapped by evil, higher powers. And resurrection of some sort occurs for them when they are enlightened of who they are. And then that's completed at death. At death, then their soul is released to return to heaven. That for them is resurrection. I think that concept was rather well portrayed in the movie about Noah. Well, the church eventually fought off such silly notions, fought off the notion at least that Christ was not flesh and blood. It took a while. It took through the second and third centuries for that idea to be fought off, however. But eventually they fought it off. And that was one battle that the Orthodox Church won over the heretics. But the Hellenistic or Platonistic idea of the immortal soul, however, at the same time was absorbed into the majority church. In other words, they won the battle, but they lost the war. Because the doctrine of the immortal soul did eventually take over. Paul writes of the same notion about resurrection to Timothy. I'll just quote the verse from in 2 Timothy. Paul wrote, "Who, concerning the truth, have erred, saying that the resurrection is past already." It's an alternate definition of what resurrection is. But Paul says here in 1 Corinthians 15:13, "If there be no resurrection of the dead, then Christ is not risen. And if Christ be not risen, then is our preaching vain, and your faith is also vain." In other words, the crucifixion of a real man, followed by his resurrection from the dead, is the hope of them and us all. And if it didn't happen, then the life that you live is also in vain. If Christ were a spirit messenger and not a human being, then we have no example of a human being ever converted to a godlike being. And our faith is in vain. More hints about the heresy of the New Testament. I'll say the heresy, in my opinion. It's in 2 Corinthians. 2 Corinthians 11. Start there. 2 Corinthians 11, verse 3. "I fear lest by any means, as the serpent beguiled Eve through his subtlety, your minds should be corrupted from the simplicity that is in Christ." Just as we later see in the epistle to the Galatians, the heresy was a different gospel. It was a gospel about Christ, but a different gospel. Verse 4. "If he that comes preaches another Jesus, whom we have not preached, or if you receive another spirit, which you have not received from us," in other words, nor another gospel which you have not accepted from us, but the gospel of a different set of teachers in Corinth, you might well bear with him. Verse 5, for I suppose I was not a whit behind the very chiefest apostles. There were apostles of this heresy in Corinth. Paul has to argue that he is not inferior to these superlative or eminent apostles who are teaching his church in Corinth. They are bragging about their superior spirit-revealed knowledge, but they preach a different meaning of who Christ was and why he came. In that view, he was a messenger to reveal to the Corinthians their inner divinity. And so he fights their fire with fire in chapter 11, verse 10. As the truth of Christ is in me, no man will stop me of this boasting in the regions of Achaia. I'm going to have to boast about myself, he's saying. Why? Because I love you not, God knows. Why must I boast? To counter those who claim to be more spiritual than Paul himself. Verse 12, but what I do, that I may cut off occasion from them which desire occasion, that wherein they glory, they may be found even as we. They're no better, though they claim to be. Verse 13, for such are false apostles, deceitful workers, transforming themselves into the apostles of Christ. Yes, they preach Christ, but Christ the messenger, not Christ the man who died as a sacrifice. Verse 14, and no marvel, for Satan himself is transformed into an angel of light. Therefore it is no great thing if his ministers also be transformed as the ministers of righteousness. But they're not righteous, he says, whose end will be according to their works. They preach Christ, but they're apostles of Satan. They preach a spirituality, but the supposed liberation that they bring frees them to practice lawlessness. Hence, their end will be according to their lawless works. And these bragging apostles have impressed the Corinthians. They are boastful. But Paul is a true apostle, far more than these eminent apostles. As the New English translation translates that, he is calling them the eminent apostles there in Corinth. Well, soon after the letters to the Corinthians, Paul hears of the heresy, I say the heresy, hears of heresy at least, in Galatia. And he writes the letter to the Galatians. And here again, he makes a connection to super spirituality or to the knowledge of the spiritual. Galatians 1, verse 8. But, breaking into the thought, verse 8, 1:8. But though we or an angel from heaven preach any other gospel unto you, and some were preaching another gospel, which we have preached to you, let him be accursed. Very strong language. The heretics seem to claim again to be in contact with heavenly messengers, the representatives of the one true God. But Paul says, don't believe them. Even if an angel told you that, don't believe him. They bring another gospel. Chapter 3, verse 1. It is another gospel. Foolish Galatians, who has bewitched you that you should not obey the truth? And what is the truth? Before whose eyes Jesus Christ has been evidently set forth, crucified among you. Death by crucifixion is crucial to Paul's gospel, not theirs. The heresy is that Jesus did not come in the flesh, that he was a spirit. But Paul's gospel was that Jesus was flesh, that he could bleed and die. Otherwise, he couldn't have died as that sacrifice. But the heresy denied it. They claimed that Jesus was a spirit sent from God, that Jesus was too spiritual to have ever touched, or at least let alone become, flesh. The holy gods could never become flesh. Romans was written directly after Corinthians and Galatians in the mid-50s, or mid to late 50s. There's not much in there about heresy, though, however. Paul doesn't seem to fight against the heretics in Rome, probably because he's never been there, never met them. Maybe they aren't there yet. They haven't arrived in Rome yet. But he does continue to emphasize in Romans the message that Jesus Christ was flesh and that he died as a sacrifice. I'm not going to turn there. There are no outstanding examples of the heresy in Rome. Next chronologically are the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, which seems a little counterintuitive. Chronological, you think, you know, the events of the Gospels are much earlier than the epistles of Paul, but they're generally accepted to have been written in the 60s A.D. There are a couple of writers in the second century who state that Matthew was written in the native language, which had been Aramaic. There might have been an earlier version of Matthew. But all the Gospels, as we have them, are written in Greek because they were sent to Paul's churches. They were sent to reinforce the Gospel to the Greek churches of Paul's area. They document the true nature of Jesus Christ to Greek churches which were going wrong. They were growing in confusion about who Jesus was because there was a heresy out there. Many of the things that the gospel writers are probably recorded in those gospels probably to counter those wrong ideas about Christ that were being promulgated in the Gentile churches in the 60s. This is why we have, for example, the story of Christ's birth in the gospels. He wasn't starting a Christmas tradition, was he? He wrote the story of Christ's birth to emphasize how the Son of God became flesh, which was contrary to the heresy. This is why we have the accounts in the Gospels of all of the traveling of the 12 disciples with Jesus for 3.5 years, all the intimate relationship, the eating and the drinking and the walking and the sleeping, that he was a man, and they knew it, flesh and blood. Luke records Jesus saying this, from Luke 24, "Behold my hands and my feet, that it is I myself. Handle me and see, for a spirit has not flesh and bones as you see me here." Now, the Gospels are proving that Jesus was flesh. Matthew records Jesus saying this. This is in Matthew 26. "For this is my blood of the New Testament, and which is shed for many for the remission of sins." Right? The whole emphasis of the Passover symbolism, bread and wine for flesh and blood, was to prove and emphasize that Jesus Christ was flesh and blood, not a spirit. I mean, that's not the whole reason the Gospels were written, but those examples are chosen to place in the Gospels to counter that confusion. Okay, then the prison epistles would come next. In the early 60s, around 61 through 63, Paul is imprisoned in Rome for the first time. And from there, he's battling the heresy by letter. We'll find a characteristic in Ephesians. A characteristic of the heresy. Ephesians 1, verse 20. He's talking about the power of God. He says, "Which power God worked in Christ when he raised him from the dead and set him at his own right hand in the heavenly places, far above principality and power and might and dominion and every name that is named." He lists the same things like, you know, power and principalities in Colossians, in the first chapter of Colossians. They were written about the same time, Ephesians and Colossians. He's emphasizing the same thing. The heresy is that Jesus was a spirit, as I said, a messenger from God, who fits into some angelic hierarchy, which they call principalities and powers, which dominate men and keep us trapped here in our physical bodies, our immortal souls trapped in our physical bodies. But Paul is arguing in Ephesians and Colossians that Christ has died and been raised far above those supposed principalities and powers. Philippians, written about the same time, another prison epistle. Philippians 3:18. Paul says, many walk, of whom I have told you often and now tell you even weeping, that they are the enemies of the cross of Christ. Some are preaching to the church, but they deny the cross. They deny that Jesus Christ could even die, let alone die on a cross. We have actually a name from history, not in the first century, but just after it, of such a person who preached such a thing. This is from, who wrote this? Peter Whitelaw wrote this, Basilides. Basilides, an Egyptian, was at the height of his power in Alexandria, circa 105 AD, just after the apostles. The Basilidians espoused that Jesus did not die upon the cross, but his place was taken by Simon of Cyrene. Now, whether Basilides was a Syrian or a Samaritan or a Jew is not quite clear. I tend to think he was probably Jewish in the big Jewish learning center of Alexandria. But he was teaching this heresy among the Christians of Alexandria that Christ did not die. Christ could not die. He was not a human being. He was a spirit messenger. But he's a prime example, though of a later time, of what it means to be an enemy of the cross of Christ. He opposed to the idea that Christ's death was a sacrifice. Colossians 2, verse 18. Philippians, Colossians. Colossians 2, 18. Let no man beguile you of your reward in a voluntary humility and worshiping of angels, intruding into those things which he has not seen, claiming to have seen them, but not having seen them, vainly puffed up, vain, bragging, in his own mind. The heresy in Colossae obviously did involve angels, did it not? It was Jewish. Only the Jews cared about angels. The Gentiles didn't know such things, didn't have such a term. Anyway, it was the worship of angels, as if there was an angelic hierarchy that stood between them and God. So their worship had to go through angels, and apparently Christ was a spirit, in their interpretation, who fit into that hierarchy. And that's what Paul is countering in Colossians as well as in Ephesians. Then about the same time, and I think it was about the same time, and to about the same audience, the letter to the Hebrews, which I think is one of Paul's prison epistles, in the early 60s. First of all, in Hebrews chapter 1, we once again see Paul countering the idea that Christ is a spirit who fits into an angel hierarchy. Hebrews 1, verse 4. Christ being made so much better than angels, as he has by inheritance obtained a more excellent name than they. As the Son, that is, Jesus is resurrected to a position much better than any angel. But the book of Hebrews goes on to explain in detail a lot of things about Jesus' sacrifice, does it not? How it replaces, how Jesus Christ as the high priest replaces the ritual law of the Old Testament. Now, why would this be necessary to be written to Jewish Christians in the Anatolian Peninsula, which I think is the audience of the book of Hebrews, Jewish Christians in the Anatolian Peninsula, Turkey, Asia Minor? What would Jewish Christians who have almost never offered a sacrifice in their life, being hundreds of miles from Jerusalem, what would they care about the real meaning of the altar and the real meaning of the sacrifices? Now, the Jews back in Judea are still worshiping at this time at the altar of sacrifice, as the covenant of Sinai required. But the Jews of the diaspora, the Jews out here in the Roman Empire, were far from the altar of sacrifice. They had long been working out how to deal with this fundamental problem of being a Jew and not being able to practice the Old Testament religion, which they could not, since they had no altar. They could not practice the Old Testament religion. Some of them had worked out alternate meanings for the temple ceremonies. Some of them had. Some of the philosophies of Hellenistic Jews In their philosophy, the law was interpreted as a pattern of how to access the true God through a heavenly temple presided over by angelic priests. An example of such a philosophy is Philo, the Jewish sage of Alexandria, heavily influenced by Greek thought, totally agreeing with Plato and his doctrine of the immortal soul, but Jewish. But in that scheme of things, they did not require a sacrifice. There was a spiritual sacrifice through the angels of the spiritual temple. They did not require a sacrifice. So the idea of Jesus' human death as a sacrifice, not needed. In their philosophy, Jesus was a messenger. His death as a sacrifice was not required. Against this, I think, stands the letter to the people, the Jewish Christians, the letter to the Hebrews. It stands there to say that Jesus' death was required, that it fulfills the Old Testament, that Jesus Christ is the sacrifice, he is the high priest, that all those rituals are done away with. Next, the book of Acts. Chronologically, again, that's a little counterintuitive, but the book of Acts only records history up to the time of Paul's first imprisonment in the early 60s. So it must have been penned right about that time and was never finished, if you will, never extended beyond that time. It doesn't say much about the heresies or where it's coming from. I wish he did, but maybe they didn't want to dignify the heretics by naming them. I don't know why. But he does name some of them. For example, in Acts we see a lot of strange Jewish ideas. We see Simon Magus in chapter 8. He was a Jew. I think he was a Jew. He preached in Samaria, but I believe he was born in Judea. There was a strange Magus magician called Elymas that Paul and Barnabas encounter in Cyprus in chapter 13. And then there are those unnamed certain men who came down from Judea to Antioch and preached circumcision and argued at great length with Paul and Barnabas in chapter 15. So there are strange ideas floating about in the Jewish world that, you know, the Jews are not all practicing Judaism. Right? They're... By the time of Paul's letter to Titus in the mid-60s, about 65, he's referring to these heresies as Jewish fables. Titus. I won't turn there, I just got one verse. Titus 1:14. Not giving heed to Jewish fables and commandments of men that turn from the truth. The men who are preaching these are probably Jews, but they're not Jews of the synagogue. They have some strange ideas. By the time of 2 Timothy, the heresy is hurting the church, as I already read at the beginning of this message. Paul wrote to Timothy, "This you know, that all they which are in Asia be turned away from me." That was in the late 60s. And then shortly after that, Paul was executed. He dies in the late 60s, caught up in the Roman persecution, probably. And apparently then we take up the story with Peter, because Peter apparently writes his epistles as encouragement to Paul's churches after the death of Paul. 1 Peter begins this way. 1 verse 1. Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ, to the strangers scattered throughout, and then he lists a bunch of Roman provinces: Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia. These are all in Anatolia, the Anatolian Peninsula. Not that Paul had started churches in all these provinces, but he did start the churches in Asia and in Galatia. And apparently the church had spread throughout the Anatolian Peninsula to all these provinces. Peter is addressing Paul's territory, or at least the descendants of Paul's churches. In 2 Peter, we see this snatch about what Peter says about the heresy. 2 Peter 2 and verse 1. There were false prophets also among the people, speaking of the Old Testament, even as there will be false teachers among you who privately will bring in damnable heresies, like what? Denying the Lord that bought them. I don't think these are lay members of the congregation who are going to rise up and teach each other this. These are teachers who will rise up, Peter says, and infiltrate the church. The same kind of apostles that Paul dealt with in Corinth. They deny the Lord that bought them because they deny that Jesus Christ was God's Passover lamb. Now, Paul preached the church had been purchased with Jesus' own blood, but they deny that he shed that blood. Their doctrine of the Spirit Christ denies his role as a sacrifice. And this brings us to the end of the 60s, the end of Peter's letters. Then we have a long gap from about 68 to 90 AD. We don't have any new letters written in the New Testament. But then we have the writings of the Apostle John, who's by that time working in Paul's territory in Ephesus. And by this time, by 90 AD, as I began this message with a quote from John, the heresy is very pronounced. It's growing very big. John's gospel was probably written at about this time, at about 90 AD. And John's gospel stresses that Jesus Christ came in the flesh. Begins, the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us. Remember that from John chapter 1. And as in the other Gospels, the Gospel of John is big on the Passover symbolism that emphasizes the humanity of Jesus Christ. For example, for my flesh is meat indeed, and my blood is drink indeed. He that eats my flesh and drinks my blood dwells in me, and I in him. That's from John chapter 6. And we go through this at the Passover, of course, emphasizing the humanity, the blood, the flesh and blood of Jesus Christ. So John is affirming that Jesus Christ was a real man, that he really died. John's account includes the point about, no pun intended, the spear being thrust into Christ's side, that he bled blood and water. And the Apostle John's gospel is recognized as being pointedly against the heresy that was invading the church in those days. And then sometime after writing his gospel, apparently, John wrote his general epistles when the heresy was quite strong. 1 John 1, verse 1. That which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we have looked upon and our hands have handled. He's the last of the witnesses of the 12 disciples. And as I read at the beginning in chapter 4, verse 2, every spirit that confesses not that Jesus Christ is come in the flesh is not of God. And this is that spirit of Antichrist. And then finally, at the end of the New Testament, in the mid-90s, maybe the late 90s, the book of Revelation, also again written to Paul's territory, the seven churches of Asia, where the heresy was very strong. Just pick out a couple. Revelation 2:2. Revelation 2:2, this to Ephesus. John writes, I know your works and your labor and your patience and how you cannot bear them which are evil. And you have tried them which say they are apostles. They say they are apostles. The eminent apostles. Been around since they taught the brethren in Corinth. And are not. And have found them liars, as John calls them. Verse 9, this to Smyrna. I know the blasphemy of them that say they are Jews and are not, but are the synagogue of Satan. They oppose John's gospel. This is a strong affirmation, I think, that this heresy was borne by men who were indeed Jews, but they do not practice the Jewish Old Testament religion. Theirs is a spirituality that's drawn from the mystery religions of Babylon and Greece, from the Hellenistic ideas of the man's origins, the Plato doctrine of the immortality of the soul. They claimed to understand the spiritual meaning behind the law, the real meaning of those temple sacrifices, but they do not practice the substance of it. The laws of the sacrifices nevertheless still occupied a central place in the ideas of everyone in the first century of how to worship God. The law of the temple. It's hard for us, I think, in this day and age to fathom the importance of a sacrifice. We've never made one. You know, not a blood sacrifice. In Judea, of course, the temple was still there, and it was the focus of worship. But here, in Paul's territory, in the diaspora, many held a kind of reinterpretation of the laws of sacrifice. And some apparently espoused a ritual replacement of those sacrifices. In the territory of Paul's churches, as I said, the Jews had long dealt with the problem of how to keep their covenant with God when they couldn't do the religion that God prescribed. But they came up with a solution that was not the sacrifice of the Messiah. Ours, however, our solution to how to worship God is a sacrifice. It is a sacrifice of the Messiah. Next Sabbath is the Day of Atonement. Atonement, the great day of reconciliation. Reconciliation of billions of people all over the world. They're all reconciled to their Creator, as Paul wrote to the Romans, it will come to pass that in the place where it was said to them, you are not my people, there will they be called the children of the living God. That's from Romans 9:26. A sacrifice of reconciliation, a great atonement. And there will be no need for animal sacrifice at that time to do it. There will be no shedding of the blood of bulls or goats. We won't do it next Sabbath either, of course. The law of the tabernacle has been fulfilled. It has been done away with. Note Paul's language. This is from Romans 7. Wherefore, brethren, you also are become dead to the law by the body of Christ. Whenever Paul talks about the doing away with the law, doing away of the law, he speaks of it in conjunction with the body of Christ, which replaces the law of the sacrifice. He is the sacrifice. Or this language. Almost all things are by the law purged with blood, and without shedding of blood is no remission. That's from Hebrews 9:22. All of it has been replaced by one sacrifice, and you well know that. The atonement was made by God's own firstborn Son, in whom we have redemption through His blood, as Paul wrote to the Ephesians. There is no other access to God's throne, and He shed real blood. Jesus also, that he might sanctify the people with his own blood, suffered without the gate. That's from Hebrews chapter 13. So shedding of blood is crucial to a sacrifice. This is why he died. This is the meaning of his death. And then he was resurrected bodily to show his triumph over death, to show that flesh and blood can become immortal. This is our hope. His death as a sacrifice and his resurrection as the firstborn from the dead requires that he die as a man. And this is why every spirit that confesses not that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh is not of God, as Paul wrote. This is why the apostles insisted over and over again that Jesus had a body, a real body of flesh and blood, and he died as a sacrifice.